We are back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Holidays of all kinds usually involve eating. There are special foods, recipes, or flavors we associate with a particular holiday. Hot dogs on the 4th of July, say, or turkey and cranberries on Thanksgiving, or latkes on Hanukkah.
Christmas has as many food traditions as there are cultures that celebrate it. But Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik says there are three foods and flavors that specifically come to his mind.
Christmas is so rich for food historians because there's so many things that if you don't have them, it's just, well, that's not the holiday season. No. And gingerbread houses, ginger anything, which is the strangest thing when you think that the root was originally found in Indonesia, made its way to India, then traveled to China and the Middle East, and really didn't, I mean, the first recipe, by the way, that we have for ginger is in the time of Julius Caesar, 240 BCE. And, you know, and it's always been lauded by royalty. There's some Queen Elizabeth history, Elizabeth I, by the way. And there's some Julius Caesar history. And then Henry VIII used it or tried to get it concocted into a drink that he could serve to, well, his inner staff and those that mattered during the plague as a form of staving off the plague. Little did he know it just helps with indigestion, which the man also had a lot of as well. But, you know.
Can't do anything for the plague,
right.
But it does make your tummy feel better.
Right. Humanism is nice, but they had less science in those days. So the root makes its way up into India and into China, and it becomes crucial in Chinese cooking, and it's part of the Middle East. And there's arguments about how it made its way into Europe. Some say the spice road. Many say, and there's evidence to support this, but was it the first way? The Crusades. And the Crusades were vital in bringing, they were almost an early precursor in food experiences and new ingredients coming to Europe, an early precursor to what the Columbian Exchange later with Christopher Columbus coming over to, you know, the Americas and then bringing things back, and then the exchange between Europe and the Americas. So the Crusades were fantastic because they brought ginger and oranges and all these grains and styles of cooking and manners of thinking about food back with them while they were trying to make basically, you know,
Infidels do what they wanted.
Safe for Christendom. But so there's also some argument that was it a monk who made his way into France and he started cooking there. And ginger's got a really interesting story within religious people because it had certainly from the 1300s on been part of baking and cooking within monasteries and nunneries. There's even a little French kind of cookie. Well, it's a little higher than that. It's almost like a cookie on steroids biscuit that French nuns have been making for about 600 years that they paint little white windows on, and it's heavy with ginger.
One of the things I love about ginger is that it's both savory and sweet. You
right?
can use it in any way you can think of, practically, and it somehow works.
Yeah. Yeah, it adds so much to things. It doesn't take a great deal of it. Most of what was traded became ginger powder throughout Europe, so a dried form, transported well, could be kept. Queen Elizabeth I really brought it into fashion, and food is nothing but fashion, let's be honest. Whether it's good for us or not, we may not be eating it, but if it's on trend, we'll certainly say, I'll have that. Small plates all the way through kale. Queen Elizabeth loved her gingerbread cookies. She used to have them decorated for the luminaries that were visiting her court. And then to celebrate in kind of a coy and backhanded way, the suitors that were trying to win her hand. She basically is credited with the first one to design decorated gingerbread cookies. And they're gingerbread men because they were always men because the aristocracy, the diplomats and so forth that were visiting the court. And then, of course, the suitors were. There's some argument that the reason that we have our silly-looking gingerbread men, which are more like babies, is that it sort of transitioned into celebrating the Christ child, and that evolved over time. But there's no doubt, certainly we've got all kinds of great research on this, that the gingerbread cookies were used year-round, and they were decorated to celebrate the seasons. But this was a high-style kind of compliment. If Queen Elizabeth said, I'd like you to have this cookie, it was almost like a better calling card. It was like having a bust done of you. You showed up at this event, and she had done a cookie in your honor. Then this was a really big deal.
Were you allowed to eat them?
Yeah. Okay. You were supposed to. In fact, there was even legend that if you ate them, if single women ate them, it would move them towards either being married or conceiving. I don't think anyone's walking around eating gingerbread cookies nowadays, but hoping for those
for
things.
That,
yeah, for that reason, yeah. The gingerbread house, strictly German. That's Brothers Grimm. And we cannot find sources whether Brothers Grimm talked about Hansel and Gretel in the Gingerbread House or gingerbread houses existed beforehand, and then they wrote the Hansel and Gretel story. We know that the Hansel and Gretel story and the witch fattening up the children was based on a famine that had just gone through Germany. We know based on when the story was first written, so it was a bit of a response to that. But those two work hand in hand, and you know, then we end up with these monstrosities like the largest gingerbread house in the world, which the Mall of America had in 2006, and then some wackadoo in Texas had to outdo with like a two-story thing a couple of years ago.
People, I just want to
calm down. Yeah, right.
Gingerbread.
Yeah.
I don't need to build houses out of gingerbread. I really don't.
Right.
I just enjoy it. There's that smell of gingerbread baking in the oven. It's the ginger and the molasses and probably the brown sugar, the combination of all of those things and the other spices that you'd put in there.
Right.
That to me, it doesn't just say the holidays, it's the warming thing for winter.
Oh, no question.
Yeah.
And it is that staving off. In fact, George Washington's mother made gingerbread bread as a treat for a visiting French dignitary and became named after him within the Washington recipes and was passed down. But it was a winter thank you after we had won the Revolutionary War with the French help. So there's a rich tradition in there, and it's moved its way through so many. I mean, whether you're Scandinavian or Polish or German or, you know, any sort of European experience, it's really used. And then, of course, heavily in Asian cooking, but not as the powder for baking.
No, I was going to say much more the savory.
Yeah.
That side
we own that. Yeah,
yeah,
definitely. So the other interesting, I think, thing that we just take for granted that's always been there in the holidays are candy canes. And the story of those is really not all that glamorous. They started out as sugar sticks, and they were tiny little, you know, snap a pencil in half and about that length. And they'd be attached with string or something to the greeting card that you gave at the holidays. So it was this lovely peppermint sugar flavored, and they were just white. They were just white. Along came a gentleman in the early teens of the 1900s who built a machine, to curve them slightly, and the red twist was added simply as a Christmas color. Folks that love religious iconography started to say, oh, it's the shepherd's hook for Jesus, and, you know, the red is the blood of Christ or whatever. No, sorry. They were just sugar sticks, and someone came up with a way to bend them so they were more memorable. Before he came up with this machine, people would bend them as sort of a decorative aspect and a way to hang on to them, literally, and certainly decorate trees with them. This was one lovely little treat for a kid. I mean, this was not, you know, the tree full of them. But so they were all kittywampus. I mean, you didn't see the same shape of a candy cane that you see this regularity now when you walk into a Walgreens or something like that, and you just see thousands that are all perfect. But the industrialization of that candy and then the red twirl, it's really, well, just over a 100-year-old tradition.
But people were using peppermint before that.
A long time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sugar sticks with peppermint flavoring goes back a couple hundred years, no question. And it was a way, and again, Dickens really, you know, in that Christmas experience, so many of these tastes go back to things that he listed out in his book, the mincemeat pies as well. I mean, that couldn't be more British. And that was taking the offcuts, what we would now call ground beef, but they didn't have the industrialization to grind it up. It had table grinders, and seasoning it with what we now consider as Christmas flavorings, the cloves and the spices and the cinnamon and those sorts of things, the dried fruits. That mincemeat pie made its way to America as fruitcake, which I don't know about you or many of our listeners, but, you know, not my favorite. And the evolution of that is when Dickens was talking about it, most of his readers and much of America and certainly a lot of England was still cooking over open hearths, right? So when you've got this big pot going, it's easy to put something to the side and have it boil. And you would basically put together what they called a pudding, wrap it in a cloth, and boil it in water. And then you'd take it out of the cloth and you'd pour treacle over it. And, you know, this was this great savory, sweet kind of thing. And you were also eking out another meal for everybody. You were pulling together all these things, throwing in a couple of modest ingredients with one or two expensive ones, and you had this delicious treat. Well, when you get to America and we're starting to romanticize the British version of Christmas, you put them into our ovens. What it does is it just dries it out. And how do you make that better? Add some rum. Bada bing, bada boom. Fruitcake. I mean, there are umpteen ladies' home journals and so on and so forth from the 30s through the 50s that basically say the well-laid table has a fruitcake on it. So this was a way to show that you had achieved a certain amount of cooking acumen, you had arrived, and you must have this. I don't know how people got through them in those days because I don't really get through them now.
It was the rum.
Yeah.
It was the rum.
Probably.
I was going to say the British idea of, you know, of having it be that mixed flavors to me sounds so much more interesting. Fruitcake is all on the sweet side.
Oh, yeah. And our separation now in palates, if you go to a restaurant, there's savory and those are the first, you know, appetizer through entree and then dessert. That separation only happened in the late 1700s, early 1800s, at least in England, which we mirror in many ways, within the upper classes. So they started splitting away with the sweet things and then their entrees and so forth were the savory. Most of the rest of the world blended them together as they would. So the puddings that they were eating were this great combination, something that I prefer more. I mean, you know, one of my favorite candy bars is a Snickers because it has that great, right, halfway point.
And I love meats with fruits.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of having a sour cherry preserve with a piece of pork or with poultry or something like that, pomegranate sauce with that. It's the mix of those, the rich flavor and kind of the tart fruits. And the,
right.
It's delicious.
When you're eating that way, you're actually eating more authentically through history because that's how more people ate. The last thing that I want to bring to people's ears for this Christmas time is that lovely navel orange that I grew up getting in the toe of my stocking, whether it was St. Nicholas, some people celebrate that, or on Christmas morning. I think it's fallen off a little bit, but it used to be such a thing within the experience of the American Christmas and holidays because citrus fruit was in season. But that navel orange in and of itself has got one of the most fantastic stories. It was 1870, and there was an orange tree in Brazil that the Secretary of Agriculture realized this is really something, had them first shipped to the agricultural gardens in Washington, D.C., where they didn't do so well, then more of them shipped down to Florida, where most of the crop died, had the final three sent to Riverside, California, to a lady who was basically the friend. Her name was Eliza Tibbetts. She was a friend of the secretary. And at that point, it was, you know, well, let's see if you can do something with these, because they're sweet, they're big, they're juicy, they have no seeds, they peel easily. I mean, this is really a fantastic fruit. But it was on its last legs. And the fact that these trees went all the way from Brazil to Washington, Washington to Florida, Florida to California, I mean, they'd had a rough life already. And the navel orange that we all take for granted now was, in fact, just a genetic mutation that was on one single branch in an orchard in Brazil. That navel is, in fact, another orange trying to grow out of the original orange. And as a result, we get this big, juicy, plump, no seeds, delicious, easy to peel, pulls apart like candy orange. So then it makes its way to the Americas. Mrs. Tibbetts, who thought, I can really make a go with this tree, had to argue with Mr. Tibbetts, who said, I'm not piping water to that damn plant. And so she had to water it with the dishwater that she would have her servants carry out and dump on this tree. It flourished, and so many breeders, essentially, and folks in California started coming and wanting grafts of it. So literally every tree that we have now is a graft of that tree. And
That original
tree in Riverside, California, which you can still go see. It's been ensconced in a park and is kept alive by agricultural departments in California. It's over, what would it be, almost 130 years now.
Is it still bearing fruit?
It's still bearing fruit. Now, they've got it fenced off because for a while it was really cool to go and pick one of the original oranges, right? But you can stand and honor it. But the entire citrus industry in California really grew out of the success of that one tree because then, you know, it was propagated into hundreds of versions of that tree, grafted onto other orange trees or lemons or grapefruit. Sunkist, which was originally a citrus cooperative, began solely off of the navel orange and just so many careers, employment, that whole we just think of the orchards and orchards. That came from one tree that almost didn't make it because it was shipped to Florida first, where most of the citrus was growing.
A mutated
tree. Yeah. So it really is a Christmas miracle.
It kind of is.
If you want to look at it that way. And we still carry that tradition forward because I think just having a great natural bounty of the earth gift at the toe of the stocking for your kids on Christmas Day is that's one of the treasures of the holiday.
It really is.
Yeah.
Well, now you've got me hungry.
Well.
So I think we should both go and get our feasts ready.
Yes.
And we will catch up next year.
Next year.
It's hard to say. Oh, my goodness. And I look forward to it. But I wish you and yours the very best holiday season, Kyle.
You too, Bonnie.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is the host of the award-winning television show, Wisconsin Foodie.